You know, the online world is great for so many things. It's great for making you laugh, it's great for entertainment, and every now and again you come across ideas or people that literally blow your mind. But I still think some of our best thinking happens offline. So join me, Nessa, on Offline Thoughts as I chat about some of the things I think about when I'm not online. I'm really glad you're listening, and I hope you enjoy the episode. So it happened again recently. I was on TikTok having a great time. I was watching, I don't know if you guys have seen this video of like Max the cat. It's like this terrorist little cat that goes out every day and just terrorizing the neighborhood cats. I was watching that in shock. And then because I was watching that, of course, the algorithm was giving me more and more cat videos. Then I came across like this other video where this cat is like eating like dry kibble in like a bowl. He's eating dry kibble like normally the way the cats eat. So he's got his like little snout in his bowl and he's eating normally. And then he pauses, like stands up on his hind legs, like looks to the left, looks to the right, essentially looking to see if there are any humans around. And then when he realizes that nobody's watching him, he suddenly like takes his paws and like shovels like huge amounts of kibble into his mouth, basically eating like a greedy little human being. And as I was like watching these videos, enjoying these videos, cackling at some of these videos, I thought like, one, I broke a promise to myself again that I wouldn't just be watching like aimless videos. I tried to tell myself that when I'm on social media, I'm basically doing research for my podcast or I'm engaging in something productive or educational. So I'd failed on that ground. But the second thing that I thought immediately, I got this like feeling like, ooh, like this is too good to be true. Almost like this is too enjoyable to be true. And by to be true, I mean, like, why is it that I'm having the time of my life on this platform, on TikTok right now, watching all these videos that I enjoy watching? And I haven't paid anything. I don't have a monthly subscription. I don't have to pay per video or pay per watch. There's no money has left my account. There has been no payment in kind, no pound that I have spent to be on this platform. And yeah, here I am day in, day out, having a good time, which, you know, automatically gets my mind going. And I think, okay, well, obviously I am paying in some way. I'm just paying in a way that I don't know that I'm paying. And then it takes me back to the thing that I always think about when I'm online or using the internet in general. And that's the idea that whilst you're using it for all these reasons, some are good reasons, some are like pointless reasons, like my cat videos, but whilst you're online, a lot of the time you can forget that this is like the most incredible resource probably known to mankind. Like the idea that you can go online, punch into Google or Bing or Yahoo search engines, if anybody still uses Yahoo, and just find anything that you want to find any information that you want to find any source of entertainment that you want to find. Or you can go onto TikTok or Instagram or X or Twitter, whatever it is, and just like, you know, have an online diary or like shoot off your thoughts or engage with people from across the world or share articles or watch videos that people have posted. And again, all these are incredible resources. The resources, the connectivity, the access, the ease of use, it's a phenomenal product and we're getting that product for free. And so naturally, like when things are really good, and you're not paying anything for it, and there doesn't seem to be any catch, of course there's a catch. And in this case, like clearly the catch is that we exchange our time, one, our attention, two, and then also the most valuable thing that we pay for to have access to all these amazing resources and sources of entertainment is we pay through our data. And although like I can forget about it on a day-to-day basis, like there are still like little reminders that tell me that I'm paying for these like resources and this access and this usage through my data. So I'm the kind of person who at any given time, I mean, literally even right now, I will have 100 tabs open on my laptop. And whenever you go onto a new website, as you'll know, you'll get that notification either at the center of your screen or like the bottom of your screen that says, you know, if you want to proceed onto the website, you're basically agreeing to us placing cookies on your device. And the cookies, as you know, basically monitors what you're doing, like where you click, how often you click, what you buy, what website you go to next. So, and I think the reason why you even see this pop up recently is because they legally have to now, because I remember a time when that never was the case, whereas now literally every single website will have that notification. So when they ask you that, like, And I'd like to say I'm the kind of person who has the will to all the time, like, click and look at all the options and all the vendors that are, like, that you're agreeing to have cookies placed on your device and to who you're consenting to track you. Like, I try to, like, say no or to, like, look at them and unclick all the ones I don't want following me. But honestly, sometimes you just want to go into Reddit or go onto, like, the article you want to read or go onto the thing that brought you onto the website in the first place. So you just click, like, accept all, or if it gives you the option, it gives you the option on, like, more ethical websites where it says something like consent to only essential or accept to all or accept to none. And I will click, of course, accept to only necessary. But a lot of the time, honestly, I'm too lazy and I'll just, if it doesn't give me that option, I will just, like, accept all. And in that moment when I just, like, flippantly or, like, recklessly, I would say click accept all because I'm too lazy to take, like, the 2 minutes it takes, not even 2 minutes, it's probably, like, honestly, like, 30 seconds to open up, like, see all vendors and then just unclick everything to, like, don't follow me. In that moment when I just proceed and say, like, yeah, it's fine, just monitor me or follow me or track me, I'm actually making a very big decision, but I'm making it, like, so recklessly. And what I mean by that is that in that moment, in refusing to take, like, the 30 seconds or a minute to, like, unclick all the vendors and, like, set my privacy setting to, like, the most robust settings, I'm basically giving away my right to privacy, my right to research things and look up things and be online unobserved. I'm giving up my right to not be manipulated by these hundreds of vendors. And when I say hundreds, it is literally, it is hundreds. Next time that, like, pop-up comes up and it asks you for consent, just click the privacy, like, click the settings and click the vendor list to see who is following you, and you will see that it might have, like, 50 vendors, but within each sub vendor they themselves have vendors. So you probably have, like, hundreds of private companies that you don't know, have never heard of. You've just consented to them placing cookies on your computer, and you've consented to not only them following you on that website. A lot of the time you're also consenting to them following your activity when you leave that website and following your activity, like, even on just the device itself. So even when you are not on the website or online, you're consenting to them seeing how you use your computer, the kinds of things you do on your device, on your personal private device. So it's a big decision, and the way that they position it, it seems like they're asking you whether you want, like, to, like, ketchup or mayonnaise with your chips, with your fries. That's how it feels. It feels like such a small decision, but it's actually a very, very big decision. And whilst, like, sometimes I think, what's the worst case scenario? Okay, you're going to, like, monitor me online. You're going to see the kinds of things that I buy. Like, I already know, like, I buy a lot of stuff on Amazon, for example. I'm an impulsive shopper when it comes to Amazon, and I specifically buy, like, power tools that I never use again. I've got a great collection that just collects dust and rust. So I think to myself, like, what's the big deal? Like, they're going to see that I buy stuff on Amazon. They're going to try and sell me, like, tools that I honestly probably want to buy anyway. Or if I'm doing something else, like, I don't know, reading a political article, like, there's nothing to sell me in that case. But that's because my imagination sometimes, and I'm a pretty skeptical person, but sometimes you have a very narrow, like, perception or imagination when it comes to, like, villainy. Like, because you aren't a villainous person and you don't have, like, evil aims or, like villainous aims, your mind can't even conceive of what that data could be used for. It's kind of like when you hear of, like, a shocking murder that was done, like, in a horrendous way or a particularly horrendous way, and because it's so horrendous, you can't even, like, wrap your mind around why somebody would want to do something that evil. It's kind of like that with the cookies. You think, like, okay, what's the worst that could happen? Because we don't understand how intimate the information they're collecting. We don't understand how all-encompassing the information is that they're collecting on us is. And more importantly, we don't understand the kinds of people this information is being sold. And all those people or all those groups or organizations that the information is being sold to, they're not just, like, people trying to sell you, like, shoes or clothes or like power tools in my case, or books or whatever it is. It's not just for commercial purposes. There's this great book called, The Cambridge Analytica Scandal. And it basically details like the Facebook scandal that happened a few years ago. And this is when it emerged. Well, not emerged, that sounds passive. Like this whistleblower basically let it be known to the world that Facebook was working with all these political organizations on the right, the Republican Party and parties associated with the far right, not even just conservative, like far, far right. And what they were doing was that they had this game on Facebook where it was like a stupid game. It's like a game where you like build, like it was like Sims, where you build like a virtual reality, or you build like a farm and you like grow stuff and you harvest the stuff, just like a mindless, silly, like just nice game to play on the commute. And what happened on Facebook is that when you downloaded that game on Facebook, or when you added it to your profile, you were basically consenting to the application and to Facebook and Facebook's affiliates and Facebook's like the vendors and the private organizations that they had partnered with. You were consenting to them having access to your messages, to all your contacts, to the messages of all your contacts, basically to like everything you've ever done on Facebook and everything that anybody associated with you has ever done on Facebook. Obviously, nobody would ever willingly consent to that kind of thing. Now, in this case, they're collecting the information so that they could build like really intricate, intimate profiles of people. So because they could have access to our messages, they had access to who you spoke to how often, to the things that you liked, they had access to all your contacts and what they did online and what their political beliefs were, what they did for a living. It got to the point where they could literally say like, I want you to go to London, like pull up all the people in London who are in the ages of 25 to 30, who are female, who earn this much money, who voted in the last election, who have left-leaning politics. Actually, they weren't asking for left-leaning politics. They were asking for people who were on, like, in the center, but like could be swung to the right and could be swung or radicalized to the far right. So they basically pulled up a profile of those people, and then they inundated them with like propaganda, basically, like information designed to warp the way that they thought, to push them over the edge from being a center, like slightly conservative leaning person, to being like a fully conservative leaning person, and then also in many cases to push them over into the far right category. And again, the way that they were able to do that is because they took advantage of our laziness, in that most of the time we are not reading the terms and conditions that come with like the downloading of applications or just using of platforms like Facebook. And so when people downloaded the game, like I do or don't do when I go into a new website and they give me that option to look at all the vendors and unclick, obviously those people were doing the same thing. They were just downloading the game. They weren't reading the terms and conditions. And then they were basically signing away the privacy of not only themselves, but literally anybody who they've ever connected to, or who they were connected to on Facebook and spoke to on Facebook or were friends with on Facebook. And then also the friends of their friends. So you can imagine how wide this network grew and how quickly it grew, and the level of access that the application had, and then also just like the influence and the impact that they had. So again, going back to like making big decisions on a whim because you lack the imagination to imagine the worst case scenario, it's like a perfect example. And actually, I just looked it up and I wanted to confirm how many like profiles they had access to through this application. So they had access to 50 million Facebook profiles. Imagine the damage you could do if you could read the messages, like the personal messages of 50 million people. You could have access to literally everything they've ever done while they were on Facebook. And not only that, have access to the things that their friends have done online, what they believe, the articles they like, the things they comment on, the things that anger them, the things that like motivate them to vote, essentially. It's very, very powerful. And actually, if you're interested in finding the book, I just looked it up for you. I read it ages ago. And it's called Mindfuck, basically, but the U part has a star. and it's called Mindfuck, Inside Cambridge Analytica's Plot to Break the World. It's written by one of the whistleblowers, who is called Christopher Wiley. It's honestly phenomenal read. You can get it on, wow, I just looked it up, you get a hardcover of it on Amazon for £1.23. I feel like that's, maybe that's secondhand, but you can get it for £10. Like, if you get it, like, regular, like, paperback. But in the book, so he talks about, like, the 50 million users whose information was accessed illegally and without their consent and through nefarious means. But he talks about how that was used. So it wasn't just used to, like, help sway, like, the 2020 election in favor of Trump. It also was used by other, like, authoritarian governments, basically, where they paid Facebook to collect all this information that detailed people's activity, and especially around, like, protests. So when governments thought that there was going to be, like, civil unrest or protests, they basically used Facebook to, one, track who was at these protests and who was at these rallies. And then because of, like, the geolocation, like, the physical tracking of people and their devices, they were able to, like, form a picture of when, like, groups of people were meeting in large clusters that indicated to the government that there was a protest or some kind of civil unrest that was going to take place. Unfortunately, in some of these circumstances or cases, they used violence against protesters. So they were able to anticipate where they were going to be, and they were basically able to, like, surround them and cause them harm. So again, like, sometimes when we are, like, online and we're, like, signing away our right to privacy, and to be honest, I'm not even trustful that even when we say don't follow me, I don't even believe necessarily that they always honor that, because again, with the Cambridge Analytica scandal, it's not as though people had ever meaningfully consented to that. They found a loophole to basically get access to people by bypassing their capacity to consent. So I'm not even saying that it's a foolproof thing that if you unclick, like, don't follow me on all those vendors that are trying to track you, or that you say, like, I don't consent to any of these cookies apart from the essential. I'm not saying it's 100% guaranteed they won't, like, follow you or use your information against you, because again, like, they want access to our information by any means necessary. And again, it takes me to what I was talking about how nothing good is free. I mean, even things that aren't good aren't, like, free a lot of the time. Never mind, like, something that is phenomenal. They are not free. Now, obviously, like, just because we are not paying doesn't mean that, like, somebody down the line isn't paying. So some of, like, the commercial rationale makes sense for, like search engines like Google, like Bing, like Safari, like Yahoo. We understand the reason why they let us use their services for free is because advertisers and businesses are paying for those services. Like, they're paying to be indexed by Google. They're paying to be in, like, the top five pages or, like, the top hit list for, like, search terms. And so for them, it's, like, worth it. Like, they pay for the Google service because they hope that we, the everyday users, are going to stumble across their website and buy whatever products or services that they're making. So it makes, like, perfect commercial sense why they allow us, the everyday user, to not pay anything for it, because they're hoping that we buy from them eventually. It's basically, like, it's a form of advertising. It literally is advertising. They're advertising their website. They're hoping that we find their website, and they're hoping we buy for them. So because that's, like, an even exchange, like, we get to use it for free, but then they get to benefit because we buy their stuff, that's, like, a fair exchange and makes sense. And even outside, like, business interests or, like, commercial reasons, it also makes sense why we have access to, for example, like, public or government services online. So, for example, the reason why you can go and renew your license online for free. Like, obviously, you have to pay for the license, but to access the website where you renew your license, that's free. Or the website you go to pay your taxes, like, all that is free, and that makes sense because it's, like, a government service and we pay for those government services through our taxes. So again, the fact that it's free at the point of use makes sense because we have kind of paid at the back end. I would say, though, that other services aren't immediately obvious. Like, for me, I always think, like, how does YouTube, Facebook, TikTok, Instagram, WhatsApp, how do they make money? Okay, YouTube is obvious. It's like advertisements. Facebook is the same thing. TikTok as well. Like, you honestly can't get away from, like, the ads anymore. Like, every third thing is an ad. Instagram, I don't know, I'm not on Instagram, so I'm not entirely sure like what the situation is there. But clearly, like the other things I've mentioned, like the YouTube, the Facebook, the TikTok, clearly it's obvious how they make money. They make money from the advertisers again. To me, what's less obvious is how a service like WhatsApp makes money. Because WhatsApp obviously doesn't have any adverts. It's not as though you're texting and then like between texting your mom and texting your sister, you'll see like an advert like trying to like sell you something you searched late, like earlier. That's not what's happening on there. You get to call people for free. You get to message them for free. You get to have video phone calls for free, leave voice notes for free. And again, it's like, how do they make money? How does what the WhatsApp company make money? I've also started thinking about like other like non-obvious like applications. So for example, there's an app called City Mapper if you're in London. And I've seen this in lots of cities. I've seen that when I was in Edinburgh. I've seen this when I'm in Dublin. I've seen this lots of places. It's called City Mapper. And it basically like shows you how to get to your location like using public transport. It's really good because it shows you live information. By live information, I mean like let's say you're in Belfast and you're going from the airport to the city center. It'll show you like the transport links available to you. It'll show you when those transport links are arriving. It'll show you if there's disruptions. It'll show you if there's traffic. It'll show you the cost of travel. And all of this is like in live, like live. It's not like you have to wait 5 minutes or 10 minutes. It's like it refreshes and like very consistently. So there might be an accident that took place on one of the motorways like an hour before, and it'll update the recommendations of your route based on that information. So a really phenomenal service. And again, it's free. And the only reason why I started getting suspicious recently is because I was trying to go to Stansted and like Stansted Airport, if you're not familiar with the airports in London. And typically I know the route that I take. I usually take like a coach from like just a stop near my house, and it's like 50 minutes on there, and then you get there and you're at the airport completely fine. On this occasion, I was traveling like at a weird hour, and so I couldn't take the coach for whatever reason, but I know there's like lots of like 24-hour buses in London. So anyway, I put in my destination and where I want to go. And then the way it shows me my route, it shows me like me making like 5-6 different connections. And because I've taken this journey like in different ways a million times, I know that I don't need to make 5 or 6 different changes to get to the airport, to get to Stansted Airport. And then on top of that, it's super expensive. It's giving me like a price tag where in my head, I think I could get a taxi all the way there for close to the amount that it's quoting me for. And on top of that, because I fly so often to see my family who are just across the water from me, I know that that's just, that price is outrageous. And then I think to myself like, like why would you want me to take like 5-6 different forms of connections? Okay, maybe I'm exaggerating. It wasn't like 5 or 6. It was probably like 4 things. It wanted me to take the bus. It wanted me to take the overground train. It wanted me to take the tube. And it wanted me to then take the express train, which is different to just like the regular train. So in my head, I'm thinking, but why would I do that in that way? Not only is it impractical, it's also not even economic. It doesn't make any financial sense. And then that's when it dawned on me, like, why would they give me the service for free if they weren't getting something out of it in return? Clearly, the transport agencies advertise with City Mapper, and they basically get them to, they get users like me or like people who use the apps to spend money on as many transport links as possible. So if 3 different transport agencies are paying City Mapper to like divert people, i.e. me, to their services, then of course they're going to recommend to people the route that maximizes the amount of travel links, like individual travel links that people use. So, you know, it dawned on me, I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. And then in that context as well, like when you go onto other like aggregating websites, like websites where if you're looking for, like let's say you're looking for a counselor, it'll be a website that just does it for free, and they've just like put together all these counselors on that website for you to choose from. You can look at their profiles, you can look at their specialisms, you can look at their educational history. And again, why would somebody go through all that effort to do that for free? And the reason why it's free for us, or free for the point of view, is because the counselors or therapists clearly pay to be advertised with the hope that we will find them and pay them for their services. So again, like, it's easy to understand the commercial reasoning behind making it freely accessible to us. Another thing that stumps me is like ChatGPT. Like, I initially started out being like, oh, isn't it just like the internet? Isn't it just like punching things into Google? Basically, the attitude I had when I first got an air fryer, my sisters and family were adamant that the air fryer was like the best thing that will ever happen to me. And I kept saying, like, isn't it just like an oven, but like smaller? Like, why wouldn't I just use my oven? Obviously, I was foolish. Like, it is the best thing ever. Same with ChatGPT. I was asking, like, why can't I just use Google? Like, it served me well for all this time. And, you know, it probably has more information, I guess, because it's so synonymous with searching for things. I don't know anybody who doesn't use Google. But I was like sadly mistaken. Like, ChatGPT is the best thing ever. Not only can you find information, it also like is your little helper. It'll draft letters for you, it'll draft schoolwork for you, it'll answer questions for you. Like, I'm doing this, studying for this thing, and I punched in like a question for an equation, and it just did the whole thing for me. Like, it told me the reasoning, it told me the pitfalls. It's just an incredible service. And again, I think like this is just too good to be true. It's too good to be free. So right now it's free to us at the point of use. I suspect as time goes by, once like we have helped train ChatGPT by asking it these questions, feeding it this information, I can only assume they're going to move to a subscription-based model, or they're going to move to a model where businesses, I guess, pay for it, but people don't. But I still don't know how that would make commercial sense, because I don't know how they could advertise on ChatGPT, because it's not like Google where you look for something and then it'll be like a billion websites offering you answers, like offering you to click onto the website to see if you can find the answer or the thing that you're looking for. That's easy to understand how that makes money, because the companies are paying to be in that search engine for you to find them and hopefully spend money on their services. But with ChatGPT, like, it doesn't have that. Like, when you ask it a question, it doesn't give you like a list of websites to go and find things. It just answers the question for you. There's no brands associated with it. There's no companies associated with it. It's just not obvious how money is made. I can only assume it's going to be kind of like Microsoft Word or Microsoft Excel, in that it's going to be like an application that comes with like with your work laptop or your work computer, and then companies have to pay for the licensing fee. So far, that's like my best guess. But the more skeptical side of me also thinks that there is a part of it that is about the harvesting of our data, or the harvesting of our information for some purpose, not just to train it, but to sell us something down the line, or maybe to like study our behavior on there, or to, I get the sense that when you're using it, it is learning you. It isn't just that it's learning how to respond to you in a way that pleases you, or learning how to give you answers that satisfy the thing that you're looking for. I get the sense that as you're using it, it's learning you, it's mirroring you, it's learning something about your behavior, it's monitoring you, it's watching you, it's studying you. It feels like the difference between like putting a DVD into your laptop and watching the DVD, there's no observation of you that's taking place, because it's just a DVD you've put into your computer. There's no software that's measuring engagement or measuring the interaction. It's just like good old watching without being watched, without being observed in return. Whereas when you're on a streaming platform like Netflix, you are watching something, but the platform is clearly watching you, in the sense that if you are always watching like crime documentaries, it's watching you and it's saying, like, this person clearly watches lots of crime documentaries. I'm going to recommend more crime documentaries so they can stay online. Or this person tends to like prefer films or series with a female lead. Well, we're going to make recommendations based on that. Or do you know what I mean? Like, it's each time you engage with the platform and you select a film or a documentary or a show, whatever it may be, it is adjusting your For You page, or it's adjusting your homepage to more entice you or to lure you or to incentivize you to be on that platform for longer. So that's what I mean by it's watching you in return. Like, it's learning you. It's not neutral. It's not the same thing as like plugging in a DVD and watching it. It's very like agile. It's very like in the moment, present. It feels like a live being. It feels human-like. It feels like, I imagine it like sitting in like a therapist's office, and you're divulging your thoughts and feelings and your preferences and your quirks and whatever else, your experiences. And they're just kind of coldly taking you in, like assessing you, writing things down, like forming a picture of who you are and your particular psychoses and figuring you out. It kind of feels like that when you're online on these platforms as well. With ChatGPT, it feels like that, but times 1,000. You know, it feels like not only am I getting like that those spidey sense feelings when something is just too good to be true, it's just so helpful. I'm not going to say it's accurate, because actually it does make some mistakes. So you should be very careful about just like copying stuff. You have to verify things, especially like factual things. You have to like go onto Google and check the dates and check resources and reference properly, because yeah, that's a mistake that can be made. But apart from that, honestly, it is so phenomenal. And again, when something is that phenomenal, of course there's a price to be paid. The price that we're paying is that we are not using it without it using us back. Like, we're not using it without us being observed. We're exchanging our habits and our behavior and our privacy and our right to function unobserved. We're exchanging that to have access to ChatGPT. And with ChatGPT as well, like, I get the feeling that my imagination as to the possible villainy is like narrow, because in my head even that answer doesn't explain fully what they're getting out of it. Because when you think about the amount of time and resources it takes to create software like ChatGPT, it's honestly mind-blowing. Think of like the millions and millions of dollars that have gone into research and development and continues to go into research and development. Think about the millions of dollars that have been spent in salaries. Think about the years it has taken to bring it to market. Think of the time and energy spent on securing licensing and securing like the right to operate and to bypass all like these legal things that they would come under, because it requires accessing so much information. Think about the millions of dollars in investment from private and public capital. Think of all of the money that has gone in. And actually, let me just look up how much it's worth, how much investment has gone in so far, because I think it'll help contextualize this. Okay, so it looks like, in fact it is, Microsoft invested $10 billion alone, so as their startup capital. And then as recently as a few months ago, they were also able to raise $6.6 billion from a venture capital group. I don't know what the name is, and I won't look it up right now. But a company that just from two sources of investment alone adds up to nearly $20 billion. And somehow, like, despite all this money having gone, despite nearly $20 billion having gone into this company, like, we're getting it for free. We're not paying a monthly subscription. We're not paying like per search. It doesn't seem like they're making any money yet. Then the question obviously is like, what's the long-term goal? Because if somebody's going to pay that much money for any company, they clearly understand the value of that company. And the value of that company, to me, it feels like is more than just the fact that they are getting access to our data. Because again, with ChatGPT, it's very different to Google, because with Google, you'll type in like, you know, find me like a red dress, like I want to buy a red dress, or I want to buy new trainers, I want to go on holidays, or I want to book a nail appointment or a wax appointment. It makes sense how they make money, because the companies are paying to be advertised on the search engine so that we can find them and pay money. Or even if it isn't just purely like about like our spending habits, they're collecting data on, like, they're also collecting information on like what our thoughts and opinions are, like who we interact with, how often we interact with them, what the nature of those interactions are. So for example, if you're on somebody's Facebook post and you're interacting with them by liking them, that obviously has a different profile to somebody who's interacting them with them and leaving a negative comment or like putting like a smiley that shows they're unhappy. So it's showing you the nature of those interactions. It's also tracking information about like what we purchase, how often we purchase it, for how much or how much money we're willing to spend on particular goods, which can give them a profile on what our income level is and what our general spending profile is. Also, like, people aren't just looking up like Facebook and social media and like websites to buy stuff on. They're also putting in like really intimate information. Like, they're putting in information about like their sexual practices, or they're asking like sexual health questions. They're on like dating websites where they're revealing lots of intimate personal information, like the number of partners they've had, like how often they go on dates, like what kind of dates, like what kind of dating apps they're on. Are they on like Tinder or Bumble, or are they on like apps like Grindr? All that information creates different profiles of different people. So again, it makes sense why they let us have access to these like platforms and websites for free, because they're collecting really like intimate, granular information on us that can help build a profile of who we are, and package that up and sell it to like data companies or data brokers for different purposes. And then going back to what I was saying about ChatGPT, like, I feel like my imagination is too narrow, because for me, I don't know how they make money so far, but I certainly understand that nobody is going to spend $20 billion on any business unless that business is incredibly valuable. And to me, like, ChatGPT kind of has parallels with WhatsApp. WhatsApp is one of those companies where I often, like, I'm on there and I'm thinking, wow, this is a really good service. And then also, like, how do you make money? Especially in the context of how much money they spent. Like, Meta spent like $19 billion on WhatsApp. And the thing about WhatsApp is, it's not very different to Messenger. In fact, like, it's not different to like Facebook's Messenger at all. In Facebook's Messenger, you can message people that you're connected with, that you're friends with, or that you have on your phone. You can video call them, you can audio call them. You just need a Wi-Fi connection. So WhatsApp is very similar to that, in that you can video call people, you can audio call people, you can leave voice notes to people, you can message people, like literally the same functionalities with Messenger. And so the question then is, why would Meta, like the owner of WhatsApp and the owner of Facebook, pay for WhatsApp when it's literally the same thing as Messenger? Now, when I was doing my research, like, there's loads of theories on why that is. One of the theories that people think is that Facebook basically has thought ahead and they're trying to prevent like an instant messaging based social network from springing up to challenge its position or its dominance. So by preempting that, by having a messenger that is basically like WhatsApp, they can keep like users in its orbit, like in its ecosystem of products and services. It's basically like the same reason why they also bought Instagram, because instead of having a competitor out there to your service, it's better for you to just absorb it into your ecosystem, and then you can prevent them from becoming stronger. So I guess from that perspective, they absorbed WhatsApp into their ecosystem to prevent that from happening as far as challenging its messenger application. I'm still not sure that I'm like fully satisfied by that answer, which brings me to the other point that people raised over and over again, in that the rationale for purchasing WhatsApp for $19 billion was that it wasn't so much about like preventing a competitor from springing up, because again, other people could form like messenger-like applications or WhatsApp-like applications. What the theory is that the real point of WhatsApp is that it's designed to capture your usage or capture the way that you operate when you're using the service. So although they say, you know, one of the things you'll know about WhatsApp is that they really brag about their end-to-end encryption. And what they say is that nobody, including them, will ever have access to what you say in those messages, in those WhatsApp messages that you send to friends, colleagues, strangers, enemies, whoever it is you're texting. The thing is that even though they're not reading the contents of your message, allegedly, they certainly do know, like, where you were when you sent that message, who you sent it to, how often you messaged that person. They also know how often you receive messages in general and messages from that person in particular. They know how long it takes you to open messages or open messages from particular people. They know who the recipient is and what their behaviors are, and so on and so forth. And what that tells you is that they can form a pretty good understanding of the behavior of many different people, because it's basically becomes a network. So they know how you operate, they know how the people you text operate, they know how the people that they text in turn operate. It's very valuable behavioral usage information. On top of that, you have to remember that they are working in tandem. So WhatsApp is owned by Meta, who also owns Facebook. Facebook has access to other like metadata about you. So it also knows like who you're connected to on Facebook, how often you speak to them. It knows like how you interact with posts. It knows all kinds of things about you. It knows your phone number. It knows like when you check into events. It knows even through just like the geolocation tracking, just where you are. So by combining the information they get from you on WhatsApp and combining the information they get from you in Facebook, and then also the information they get from you in WhatsApp and all the other Meta-run services, they're able to form like a pretty good picture of who you are, especially as I'll talk about a little bit later on. When you consider the kind of information that they automatically connect, like collect on you when you consent to using their services. So there are some things that you are able to like opt out of, but there are some things that is just part of the contract that you have with them when you agree to like use WhatsApp or use Facebook or use Instagram. So I've gone on to WhatsApp's terms and conditions, like parts of it, to look at the kind of information that you agree to them collecting automatically and like the, basically the information that you can't opt out of. And like the beginning is pretty mild. They say, we collect information on users who contact you that aren't in your device address book and any users you've blocked or who have blocked you, fine. They also say that we collect information about when communities and groups are created or updated. So simply said, like, they are collecting information on who you have in your address book, like what contacts you have in your phone. And they also are tracking when you form groups and when you're part of groups and when those groups are created and when they are disbanded. In the next section, though, is where I got the creeps. So in the section titled automatically collected information, so the first headline says usage information. So they say, we collect information about your usage of our services. This includes collecting information about your activity, including how often you use our service. We also collect information on how you interact with others using our services, and the time, frequency, and duration of your activities. This also includes information about the features you use, like our messaging, calling, status, avatars, communities, groups, or business features, whether you are online, timestamps related to your usage, such as when you last used our service, i.e. last seen, and the time you send and receive calls and messages, and when you update your about information. Now, the reason why this gave me like the creeps, and there's more creepier stuff later on, but it gave me the creeps because they really brag about their end-to-end encryption. They basically reassure us that no matter what we say on this, on WhatsApp, it's never going to see the light of day, like outside the people we're messaging. Unless, of course, like your phone gets hacked by like somebody and they have access to your WhatsApp. But in terms of like the WhatsApp software, like keeping a file of what you said, they're saying that that does not happen. Like, in fact, that's their USP. Their USP is that you can text and communicate with people secure in the knowledge that you are unobserved in your communications, at least in the contents of your communications. But if they are tracking like intimate information of like how often you speak to somebody, how long you speak to them for, how often they call you and you call them, what parts, like which groups you join, also like the nature of your interaction or the nature of your activities, which is kind of vague. Like, what does that even mean? Does that mean like they're scanning the messages and they're saying this is like a positive interaction, this is a negative interaction? So that wording is a little bit vague, but still they're keenly interested in how you function when you are on WhatsApp. And it's beyond sort of like their interest in making sure that the service is working well. Clearly, if that was the case, they wouldn't need a lot of this information. Like, they can tell whether calls are being successfully placed and whether messages are being successfully delivered. They don't need to know all this other stuff for them to give you a good service, especially when the USP is the fact that you are basically able to communicate anonymously, unobserved, with the assurance that you have complete privacy. So again, like, collecting information that doesn't seem to benefit the usability or the functionality of the platform. But then it goes on under the section to talk about, like, under device and connection information, it says, we collect device and connection specific information when you install, access, or use our services. This includes information such as hardware model, operating system information, battery level, signal strength, app version, browser information, mobile network, connection information, including whether you are using Wi-Fi or cellular data, mobile operator or internet service provider, language and time zone, IP address, device operations information and identifiers, including identifiers unique to Meta company products associated with the same device or account. That is an incredibly invasive list of metadata that they are collecting on us. And again, like, clearly this information being collected goes far beyond what is required for them to, like, maintain their platform. Basically, it's more information than they need to make sure that their platform is working well. And I'll give you an example of, like, why it gives me the spidey senses, or it gives me the creeps. One of the things that I read in my research is how data brokers will sell battery level information, like in-time battery life information about your phone, to, like, taxi providers. Like, let's say you use Uber or Bolt or whatever, or Lyft, whatever application you use for taxis. They will jack up the price when they know your battery is low, because they know that you are desperate for a taxi. So imagine yourself, like, you've come out of a club at like 2, 3 a.m. and you're, like, alone and you're just trying to get home as quickly as possible. If your battery is on like 10%, you're clearly going to accept a higher price than somebody whose battery is on like 90% and they can afford to, like, wait and can afford to, like, compare Uber and Bolt and Lyft to see which the cheapest option is. So that is a valuable piece of information. And again, we know, or we can infer, that that information is created, or that information is being tracked on purpose, because that information doesn't directly contribute to them, i.e. WhatsApp, providing you a good service. It's unclear why they would need your battery information to be able to maintain their services or to keep their services online. And that's also the case with some of the other metadata information that I just read out in that list. Like, clearly they're going above and beyond they're being grabby, shall I say. They're being grabby about getting more information than they need to provide you that service, which tells you that that information is valuable to them. Going on to the next section in the privacy document, it says on general location information, it says, even if you do not choose to use our precise location related features, we use IP addresses and other information like phone number, area codes to estimate your general location. Again, it's unclear why a messaging app needs to have that even when you opt out of being followed precisely, they never allow you to opt out of being followed at all. So clearly having access to where you are is very important to them. And given that it's a messaging application that does not require this information to function, again, like, our spidey senses should be going off and we should be asking ourselves, like, why specifically do you need to have our location? It's kind of like all these other applications. Like, you'll go onto Candy Crush or you'll go onto, like, an application like Notes, and when you go into your settings, every now and again, I actually do go onto my settings to see who I've given access to my location. And you'll find that all these applications who have requested as part of the download access to your location, or sometimes even applications that ask for access to your mic, even though they're non-speaking applications. It's almost as though, like, the application, like, the service they give you is a decoy for, like, the real purpose. And the real purpose is to harvest information on you. And even that is too vague, because information could be for all kinds of purposes. It's like they're trying to collect as much diverse information about you, because presumably they've got a very diverse base of clients or clientele that they need to sell that information to you. So some companies clearly are interested in what you say. Some companies are interested in the media that you send to other people. Some companies are interested in your behavior in terms of how often you use your device or how often you communicate with people. Other companies are interested in like the things that you purchase. Other companies are interested in the things you look up online. They have clearly like an endless list of people they're trying to pimp us out to. And the reason why they use these decoy applications to get access to all this treasure trove of information is because they need to make sure they can have access to as much information as possible to sell on later on. And what really makes me like giggle in pain at this document is they basically give you a reassurance that despite the fact that they're collecting this incredibly invasive information on us that goes well beyond the pale of what the average person thinks that they're consenting to, they tell us that they have like the strictest like security levels and that they audit themselves to make sure that they're not violating our privacy in ways that aren't unethical, which is laughable considering like the company that's saying it. It's literally the company that was forced to go in front of Congress a few years ago after the Cambridge Analytica scandal came out and explain to the public and to legislators why it was they had consented to this particular company in the Cambridge Analytica scandals, but also many other companies. They had to explain why they had willingly allowed these companies to violate the privacy of millions of Facebook users. And this same company, Facebook, is expecting us to believe that they are in a position to audit themselves to make sure that they're not violating any ethical lines as far as sharing our data goes. Okay, sure. Like for me, the takeaway from this episode is really something I learned from the Cambridge Analytica story is that like just assume that everything you do on your device is not private. You know, it's like in those old spy movies when they had to communicate something important to like their handlers or to like people they were working with. Like they always met in person. They met in a park somewhere and they spoke freely. And the reason for that is they always assumed that they were bugged in some way. The thing about our phones is that they are literally a bugged device. It's a device that monitors absolutely everything you say and do at all times. On top of that, it's a device where you have probably hundreds of vendors, honestly, even thousands of vendors who you have agreed to have access to your phone, have access to your browsing history, have access to your behavior online, have access to your messages, to your photos, to your dating apps, to your financial information, to your banking. Literally the list is endless in terms of the amount of information we have like unwittingly consented to give to these unknown people or groups or organizations in the shadows. Given that that's the case, we should just assume that our devices are not private, because honestly, they're not private. Even to the extent that if you commit a crime, for example, like one of the first things that the police will always look for is your phone, because they know that your phone is going to have a treasure trove of things that can basically incriminate you. And so if the police can like have access to your phone, and not just access to the things that you have there, but even access to the things that you've deleted. Like sometimes you think if you delete a photo and then you go into the deleted folder that it's gone from your device. That's not true. It's like a lot of the time it still can be retrieved. It takes like time and effort, but it's not lost to you forever. It's not lost to other people who want to find that information either. So again, don't assume that you can have information on there that is never going to see the light of day. Just assume that everything you do on there can or could one day be made available to other people that you don't want having access to that information. And, you know, by the way, that's why you probably shouldn't send like nude photos of yourself or have nude photos of yourself in your folder. It's not worth it. The other thing as well is I read this fascinating article by the New York Times where there was like a data breach from like some company, some data tracking company. And through this data breach, the New York Times was able to essentially like track like millions of people at like a really granular level. So it wasn't just that they could see like the dots of people on a map, the dots representing like people and their devices and the location or signal that those devices were setting off. They could see the dots on the map, but they could zoom in at those dots and be really precise about where they were. Like they could track people from going from a park to their home, to their office. And then by observing them like day in, day out, they could work out that clearly they travel to this place every day. Clearly that's their place of work. And then they go to this place every evening. Clearly that's their home. In one particular example, they tracked this guy who worked for, I'm going to say Amazon, but it's like one, like a company like that. So he worked for Amazon. So every single day they tracked him going from his work to Amazon and back again, over and over again, with very few deviations, except to go to like the supermarket or go to like run errands. But his central, like his central journey was always from his place of work to his home. One day he deviated from this and he went to a place where it was a competitor to Amazon. He only went there once, and then after that, his commute became from the new place, the place, the competitor of Amazon, to his home. So clearly he changed jobs. Instead of going from Amazon to his home and back again, he now went from like the new place to his place of work, if that makes sense. So again, this information gave so much insight into people's whereabouts, like what they do, what their behavior is. And so imagine if like that was a work device. Imagine it was like, because I've had a work mobile before, I've had a work laptop before, I've had work iPads before. Imagine if like that was like an employer or an employer issue device. They basically like know what you're up to all day long. Like you think you're going to an interview conspicuously, little do you know that they've actually already clocked that that's what you're doing. And that's like a relatively benign example, but still, like, it kind of highlights how detailed the information is. And in this New York Times article as well, they just like were able to like track so many people. They were able to track Donald Trump, for example, with Abe, what's the guy's name? Japan's like prime minister. They were able to track a day where he met with him, and they went to like a golf course, were there for several hours, and they had lunch. Then they went back to one of his hotels, and they had dinner there. And basically they were able to track the president of the United States at the time, like from the time that he got up to the time that he went back home in the evening. That's a scary level of access. If they can track like the United States president at the time, they can certainly track you and me in like really granular like level. And with the route as well that Donald Trump was taking, I mean, I hate to show him empathy, but it puts like somebody in such high risk, because if somebody can map out on a map exactly where you are in real time, then especially if you take the same route over and over again, then you can imagine what somebody who wishes you ill or who wishes you harm can do with that kind of information. So if he can be tracked, we certainly can be tracked, and we certainly are being tracked. So it's definitely worth just going into your applications or into your settings and just disabling location access to all these applications that don't need it to function. And even if they do need it to function, let's say like you're getting food delivered to your house or you're getting a taxi, it doesn't need to be active at all times. It doesn't need to be tracking your live location like every moment of every day. Actually, that reminds me that I should get a VPN. I always think, like, is it worth paying for like a lifetime subscription of a VPN? By lifetime, I mean you're paying a monthly subscription and you presumably are always going to need it. And some of these like subscriptions aren't cheap. Like, let's say you're paying like £10, £13 every month. That's a lot of money on an annual basis, and certainly like an incredible amount of money over a lifetime. So I often think it's not worth it. But in the context of how much privacy gives you, also in terms of security and safety, how valuable that is, like I'm definitely going to get one. But outside of like VPNs, like another way we can take control is just like practicing having your phone off at times. Like one of the ways in which they have managed to bypass our capacity to like say no to being tracked at every moment is that they basically made our phone like the center of everything that we do. So there would have been a time where you would have a calculator, like a physical calculator that wasn't in your phone, or you would have a clock that you would use to like set the alarm and it would go off in the morning. You'd like tap it to turn off and then that's how you would get up. Or I don't know, instead of just like being heavily dependent on apps like City Mapper, you would actually get to know the city that you lived in by like practicing getting from A to B by yourself instead of just always like punching it into Google Maps or like City Mapper or whatever navigation app that you use. So again, by making all these applications and all these functions like so in like embedded in our phone to the point where you need your phone for like absolutely everything, they made it so that we consent to having all these applications and consent to having them collect all this data on us. And we find it very difficult to envision a life where the phone or our phones aren't the center of our lives, or we can't. Sometimes it's even difficult to imagine like just walking to the shop. And this is like a 5-minute walk. I kind of sometimes imagine walking to the shop without my phone. I think, well, my card is on there. My bank card is on there and I need to tap for my phone. On top of that, my music is on there and I like to have my headphones in. On top of that, what if somebody calls me? I want to be able to message. I want to be able to receive phone calls. On top of that, you know, if anything, do you know what I mean? Like all these reasons why your phone becomes like the center of you. It's almost like this companion that you can't afford to like leave behind no matter what. So I feel like part of taking back control is like chipping away at that codependence with our devices. And one way that I try to do every now and again, when I find myself like being overly engrossed in social media to the point where it's really not fulfilling or giving me like a sense of purpose or a sense of enjoyment, or it feels like I'm just doom scrolling, is I'll practice like an evening where I just have my phone off, or I'll practice a day where I have my phone off from like the moment I get up to like 7 p.m. and then I can catch up on my correspondence, like my text messages and my calls in the evening. But it really shows you that you can have a life without having your phone with you at all times. And the second thing I'm going to do as well is like externalize as many of those things as possible so that our phones aren't like the control centers of our life. So I'm going to get myself a clock. I already have a calculator. I'm completely disabling Apple Pay on my phone because I find myself spending so much money, because you don't have to think when you spend, like you literally just tap and the money's gone from your account. Whereas at least with like a physical plastic card, you kind of think twice before you pay because you have to take it out of your purse. You have to like put it into the machine. You have to like punch in your code, or if it's like below a certain amount, you can just tap. But I still feel like there's like a more time to think and more time to like consider before you just automatically do these things or pay for these things. So again, like one of the ways of taking back control is just like disabling the thing that they've gotten us addicted to. And that thing is convenience. It's ease of use. It's like the fact that it's all in one location. And it's the fact that they've made us need them in literally every way possible. And unfortunately, the price of that dependency is like really high. The price of that dependency is that they monitor us 24/7, and they've like expanded to the way in which they monitor us. It's not even just for commercial purposes now where they're trying to target us, where they're trying to target us with like specific adverts. They're also tracking where we go. They're also tracking how we communicate with our friends and family, how long we speak to them for. Like they're also tracking information, not just on the things that we do online, but information on our devices, like our personal belongings. They're going into our notes, they're going into our history, they're going into our messages, they're going to the other apps. It's increasingly incredibly invasive. And whilst this wouldn't be a concern if we could be guaranteed who like the actor is, like if we knew who was collecting our information, at the very least we could form some kind of like risk assessment and say, okay, it's a company like Starbucks that has all the information. Like realistically, we know they're just trying to sell us coffees and like expensive sandwiches. Like we're willing to take the hit that comes from having all our information being owned by Starbucks. The problem is that we don't know who these people are. We don't know who these organizations are. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of vendors that we've already consented to having information on us. And whilst they have a phenomenally like detailed accurate, granular profile of who we are and what our behaviors are and who our network of people is, we know nothing about them. And that's a very, very scary proposition. And so with that, I'm going to wrap up this week's episode. I'm still doing research on this topic because it fascinates me, and also there's just so much to say about it. But for this week, I'm going to wrap it here, and I'll pick it up in a future episode, more specifically on like the political aims, or more like the shadowy part, or like the more villainous like components of data collection. But for next week's episode, I'm going to talk about something I really love to hate. And that is Elon Musk. And for me, Elon Musk is like such a villain. He is such a villain in so many different ways. So I'm really going to enjoy doing the episode next week. So with that, catch you in the next one. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you enjoyed the episode, I would love for you to hit the subscribe button. You can get notified when I release an episode. And yeah, enjoy the rest of your week, and I'll see you next time.